welcome to Thursday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are grateful and happy that you're with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, Prairie Public's news director, Dave Thompson, joins us. He'll review this week's news, including a preview of the upcoming Dem-NPL convention. That's this weekend in Bismarck. We'll also have our weekly A Closer Look with the Monitor. North Dakota Monitor reporter Mary Stoyer will join us. She'll bring us up to date on the high-profile energy transfer Greenpeace pipeline lawsuit. Some news to report there, and also Amy Dalrymple. She's the editor-in-chief at the North Dakota Monitor. She will also tell us what her group is looking for at the Dem-NPL state convention this weekend. But first, we begin with our weekly look at tech. It's Tech with Peck. Welcome back to Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and not that long ago, watching television, meant turning on the set and flipping through a handful of channels. Today, the choices feel almost endless. Netflix, Hulu, Disney+, live TV streaming, smart TV, streaming sticks, and suddenly the question isn't what's on tonight, it's which service has it. For many viewers, streaming promised freedom from expensive cable bundles, but with so many platforms, subscriptions, and devices competing for attention and your wallet, it can feel just as complicated as it replaced. So today, we're calling in our technology guy, George Peck, joins us for another edition of Tech with Peck, helping us through this streaming maze and helping us make smarter choices about how we watch TV. George, how are you?
I'm good. So we needed to, you reminded me, I should probably bring up, just play a little tiny bit of the Bruce Springsteen 57 Channels and Nothing On song. I mean, that's an oldie now. But when we remember 57 channels was a lot and there was nothing on. Yeah, it's changed. It's a very different landscape. And it's great because there's so much content. So we had they used to be called the SAG Awards. Actually, I'm a member of that union, so I get to vote. Called the Actor Awards now, was on Sunday night. And most of the TV nominees are not on the traditional networks. They're from the streaming services. Yeah. And most of my friends now, have you watched, you know, The White Lotus? Have you watched Stranger Things? Have you watched, is it on CBS? What? No, it's a very different landscape.
And do they even get CBS in the different streaming packages that they have? And many, I have found, don't get the traditional networks in how they handle their TV viewing at home, which to me is a shocker to younger folks. It's like, yeah, what is that?
Well, if I was a you know, legacy, there's the term, broadcaster, a local TV station or a network head, I'd be really nervous. And in fact, they are. And we see consolidation in that industry with a couple of really large, you know, local TV providers acquiring each other, Nexstar and Tegna, because the landscape is changing. And so the traditional TV broadcast and that entire network, I talked about the Actor Awards, used to be on a television network. It was on Netflix. So it's, and Oscars coming up, and for what, two or three more years on traditional network, and then it's gone to a streaming service. It's changing.
I wonder what market share, and I've not done research to understand this, what traditional cable still has, because all of us, probably with our internet providers, can get television or cable television to some extent. George, my home that we built 3 years ago, we don't have cable wiring in our house. We only have, and this was my choice, we only have Cat 6 cable that we stream all of our television with. And maybe I'm an exception there, but I just didn't see the need to keep the old cable in the house.
Well, congratulations for putting the Cat 6 cable in, because lots of new houses don't even have that, with the builder saying, oh, you don't need any wiring, just do it all wireless. If you are a really serious internet user, or you have, you know, work to do in your home, you still need Cat 6 wiring. So good thinking.
All right, George, I want to get into the wide array of decisions that we have to think about, or we should think about, and maybe haven't thought about, relative to streaming platforms. Aggregated, is it still the case that streaming services are cheaper than cable once people subscribe to what they want?
Oh, man, that's a really good question. And I, you know, the last time I had a quote unquote cable, it was probably, I don't know, it was DirecTV or Dish or one of the satellite providers. I got, you know, HBO and Showtime and a couple of the premium services and got the local channels. And I tried to figure, when I turned it off, what it was going to cost if I wanted to watch the same thing. I have a lot more now. I'm probably paying as much or more now. Now, granted that I had that satellite service maybe 15 years ago, I'm paying more than I was then, but I'm getting a whole lot more content too.
Do you play the subscription roulette game where, okay, I know that on Apple TV, Ted Lasso's going to come. I can catch up on Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon's, it's not today, but it's a similar morning, the morning show. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to subscribe for 3 or 4 months and then drop them and find something else.
Yeah, I don't, because I don't want to have to mess with that. And so I actually subscribe for a year to them because I get a better overall rate. And so if I think I'm going to last, you know, even a few months, I'm going to go ahead and pay for the year. I generally make use of them, but not necessarily enough that I would necessarily do that next year. Mm-hmm. Some of them I use a lot of. Disney Plus, for example, when I want it, I want it. But then I don't want it for like 6 months. So yep. it's
still
tough.
Pay for it, though,
it's
yeah.
tough. So I'm still subscribing for a year.
And George, now we have choices. Ad-supported plans, a little less expensive, no ads. Are ads making the comeback in streaming? Because it sure seems to me like they are.
Well, I will find out for 2 minutes and then I will pay to not see them. I have YouTube Premium just so I don't have to watch another Liberty Mutual ostrich or something run. I hate it. So I will pay to not be pitched to. I don't mind paying. Well, I do mind paying for it, but I will pay for it because I do not want to see them.
I don't want to be targeted for some reason. You know, people say, well, why not be targeted? You'll benefit from that because then you can hone in. They can hone in on what they think you might want to do. But I bring that up, George, because in my Roku system, periodically, I reset my advertising identifier key, which is evidently something that goes out to the world. And then I start over all the time. And it makes a big difference for what ads I have to stomach through for different ad-supported systems that we still watch. Do you ever do anything like that?
No, because I never watch any ad-supported systems.
You're paying for everything.
I really don't. The only thing, it's not really related to this, but we're trying to figure out why when I look, and I've got all of my ad cookie tracking stuff turned off, when I look at an ad for it comes tomorrow, a big-ass ceiling fan, the big fan.
Yeah, that's a brand name, by the way.
It's a brand name.
Yeah.
And then my wife is saying, wait a minute, why am I seeing all these ads? Because we have all our, and it's not even me, it's her on a different machine. So they're very innovative at tracking what you see.
Yes.
And then following up. And yeah, I probably would turn that off. I tried to turn it off on my web browsing and it didn't. I don't know how it's getting tracked.
Yeah.
So it's still getting tracked. And on my streaming services, I probably don't go turn them off because I never have an ad-supported platform and I wouldn't be able to see the difference.
A couple more topics, George, I want your input on. If I want to watch things in 4K and I might have two screens happening in my house, what kind of internet speed do I need?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I am a lover of high bitrate internet. And one of the reasons I live in Fort Collins, Colorado, is before we decided to move here, we discovered that the city was going to install a fiber optic internet system within the city to provide residents with either 1 gig or up to 10 gig internet speeds. So I have 1 gig fiber internet, and that's certainly plenty good. Now, before that, I lived in a town in the mountains outside Denver that didn't have any internet service. We tried some wireless services, point-to-point services, that were so bad I couldn't watch a YouTube video. So if you want to watch 4K, you know, there's a number somewhere. It's something like 4 megabits per second. So if you've got a cable internet provider or any kind of a cabled, even, I don't know about DSL,
Yeah, the old phone.
But you've got to have a cable modem of some decent speed. 100 megabits is going to be plenty. So 100 megabits or greater, if you've got the gig, you can watch 4K on probably 10 TVs at the same time or more.
What about streaming devices, George? Do you have a feel for devices versus smart TVs? I like Roku. So we have Roku televisions or a Roku device on all of our devices.
I'm a tech guy. That's it. I think it's a long O. Roku. The
right.
One O.
Thank you. I've always wondered. But that's what we have. We're in that system.
So I have gone around with that. I've had several Roku boxes, but here's my go-to device. My go-to device is the NVIDIA Shield. And the reason I use an NVIDIA Shield is there's an app that I have to have called Kodi, your son's name, right? Yeah. So K-O-D-I is the name of it.
That's and, the radio station in Northwest Wyoming, by the way.
In Kodi, Wyoming. So Kodi is a media player that I use to stream. Well, it's not officially streaming. It's playback, to be technically accurate. One of my 850 either Blu-ray or 4K movies I have on this big, huge network access storage device. I have 84 terabytes of storage, Craig.
That's a lot of storage.
It's a lot of storage, and I currently have 850 movies. And Kodi is very good at playing them back. So Kodi runs on certain platforms. It runs on Windows PCs. It runs on Macs. Runs on a Raspberry Pi computer. It runs on WebOS, which is one operating system for LG televisions, but it does not run on a Roku. So I need the NVIDIA Shield so I can watch Kodi. I also have a Roku because there are certain things that are not on the NVIDIA Shield that's on Roku. So I have two. Then I have a third one, which is a very esoteric media player called a Vero, V-E-R-O 4K. It comes from a company in the UK, and I have it for one specific reason. It will play back, and I'm going to get geeky, frame-packed 3D video. So I have a lot of 3D Blu-rays that I ripped to that big storage device, and this is the media player that will play them back in full 1080 HD 3D. So that's a very specific use case, but I had to look far and wide to find a media player that would do that. So I have three.
I want to talk about receiving over-the-air channels, George, because I think people forget about those these days. This used to be the way that many of us watched television. But where I live in south of Fargo, I can put an antenna on my roof and get about 30 or so channels, including ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, and PBS, which are the over-the-air channels I wanted to get. And I can get them in HD. I've got an app. I use a Tableau system that I can use with my Roku boxes so I can have one
with
cable
your what?
Come
your what
Roku box,
box
sorry. Thank you. I'll have to break that habit. Roku box. And I have one wire coming into my home, and then it's into the Tableau device, and then it's dispersed using my internet cables.
Yeah,
and it works.
I have something called the HD Home Run. Does the exact same thing, just different brand. The one thing about mine is, and here's another geeky thing, it is an ATSC 3 compatible tuner, which means the next wave of broadcast standard, which is ATSC 3, which is 4K, is supposedly supported by this device. Now, that's a topic for another session, but it's cool because I've got, again, an antenna on the side of my house pointing toward Denver. I scan and get, with all the HD subchannels, I probably have 80, including several PBSs and ABCs and NBCs. And there's apps now on every device in my house, and I'm watching TV over the air the old-fashioned way.
Or nothing.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, George, there's another box that has come in my purview here that I want to talk to you about. I've asked you to kind of research this just a little bit. It's called the VC box, V-S-E-E box. Some friends of mine have this box, and what it offers is, and I'm so not exaggerating too much, everything in one box for one upfront cost, $300 or $400, I think, maybe a little bit more, but that's it. And then you're getting stations in Wyoming. I can watch WDAY, if I were in Houston, I could watch Valley News Live or whatever, and stations from all across the country, and also streaming movies, and also ESPN, and also you name it. I can't believe that the thing's legal, George.
It probably isn't. Okay. And you heard me mention Kodi as being the software that I use because I want to stream my media collection off my NAS. Well, if you Google Kodi box, you will find any number of them where people have taken Kodi, put it on some kind of a media player, and then loaded it up with a whole bunch of bogus illegal add-ins that goes and grabs pirated stuff. And the actual, consortium that designed Kodi has been fighting that and trying to make that distinction for years. So these things are available. They're there. They're easy to get. depends on how honest of a person you are. I don't like stealing things, and so I don't work it that way.
I'm with you there. Yep.
I just don't. It's just a matter of, you know, what kind of conscience you have and how well you want to sleep at night and what keeps that from happening. Are you going to stay up at night worrying about it by watching pirated material? Maybe it's a trade-off. I don't know.
That's George Peck with another Tech with Peck. As streaming continues to evolve, a little guidance can go a long way in helping viewers and our listeners cut through the noise and maybe even save a few bucks doing
if
it the right way.
Honest or not, maybe, yes.
Doing it the right way. Thanks, George.
All right, man. Man came by to hook up my cable TV. We settled in for the night, my baby and me. We switched round and round till half past dawn. There was 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on.
Support for Brave Public is provided by LiveWire, offering audio, video, lighting, staging, and scenery services for conferences, meetings, and live events, serving the Prairie region and clients nationwide. More at livewirenow.com. Extra, extra, read all about it.
Gather round, everybody. Main Street continues on this Thursday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, pleased to bring in our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, how's it going?
It's going very well, Craig. How about with you?
Going well, but my weekend will not be as busy as yours will be, Dave. Of course, the Democratic Convention is coming to Bismarck this weekend, and you're going to be right in the middle of everything. Dave, what are you looking for?
Absolutely. I'm going to look at see who is going to, because they've got some challenges. They've actually got candidate challenges. Be interesting to see who gets nominations and who might be looking at other down-ballot races maybe to run there. But the Democrats are going to have a decent turnout at their convention. It's going to be over 500. So the main part of the convention starts on Saturday, and that'll come from, you know, that'll start at 7 o'clock in the morning. They have a couple interesting speakers, too. They have the mayor of Denver, Colorado, coming up to speak during Saturday's session. And, of course, former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp will also be speaking during the convention.
So, Dave, you've been to conventions now for years and years and years. Is this going to be a different Democratic NPL convention?
Yes, and this is why I think it will be. There is, you know, they smell blood in the water is what I've been saying, because the Republicans right now are kind of fracturing. There's a fracturing among what they call the old guard Republicans, the standard conservative Republicans who are at the legislature right now, and more of this group that is aligned with more of the far right wing of the party, which has taken over control of some of the party offices. So the interesting thing is what's going to happen at the end of the month at the convention in Minot, the Republican convention.
You will be live blogging this. Mm-hmm. What can listeners expect to see in your blogs?
Well, they're going to be basically who gets the nomination, what kind of tenor there is among the delegates, and, you know, just to feel what goes on, because you can walk into a convention and you almost can feel what's going to happen. And when the Republicans met 2 years ago in Fargo, you walked in the convention and you knew something was up, because there was a little tenseness in the air. And, of course, that started when they tried to kick the Dickinson District 37 out, and that failed. And there were a number of districts who said, if you kick Dickinson out, we're walking. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of tension, and that tension continues. Democrats have known, you know, they used to be known that we'd fight over what time the sun comes up. But no, they seem to be a lot more unified this time.
Let's stay on the election kind of idea here, Dave. There's been training for election workers in Bismarck. To me, that carries a little more weight these days than maybe it did in the past.
Absolutely. Well, you know, they're attending this training session, and it comes because, Governor Armstrong talked about this, said it looks like every time we get a new president, there's an election integrity bill that's passed. And he said we've never supported any of them because North Dakota being unique as the only state in the union that does not have voter registration. And the governor also said that when you look at a study of election integrity and election stability, we're like number one or number two in the nation because, hey, our elections are covered by the law. It's easy to vote in North Dakota. And fraud, he says, doesn't really exist.
I've always been impressed with the seriousness that North Dakota election workers take in what it is that they do since we moved here now 4 years ago or so. Mm-hmm. I think that carries true in what you were reporting about what the governor's thoughts are.
Absolutely.
We will see, Dave, a new I Have Voted sticker that's just been unveiled. What's it look like?
Okay, this voter sticker, instead of just I Have Voted, it says, "You betcha I have voted." How North Dakotan. And it was designed by somebody who works for the Bottineau County Auditor's Office. Haley Singer was one of a number of submissions because they had a contest to the Secretary of State's office, and she won. And it's a kind of a really neat-looking sticker, I've got to say that.
I am looking forward to wearing mine with pride.
Absolutely.
Dave, the University of North Dakota has received a book, and it's not just any book. This book is old.
It is old. It's 447 years old.
Wow.
It's written in Italian, so there aren't very many people who can actually read the language of the book. But they're displaying it at the Chester Fritz Library in Grand Forks, and it's being looked at by some people studying design at UND. And just for curiosity's sake, that this is an old book, and it's very interesting.
Hard to believe. It was published in Venice in 1582.
Really?
Wow. I know. Long time ago. Dave, let's talk about new things here. Mm-hmm. First of its kind, battery cell manufacturing, not contemplated in 1582 in Venice,
no.
But is opening in Fargo. Bring us up to date.
Okay, Packet Digital already is in Fargo. They are having some manufacturing batteries that are using lithium that's now imported from China. But their CEO, Terry Zimmerman, says the company's working up on standing an ally supply chain and is building a bigger factory for lithium batteries to be used in such things as drones and autonomous vehicles. And what they're going to do is they're not going to buy the lithium from China. What they're going to do is look to the North Dakota oil patch, because in produced water, they found that produced water contains lithium. So this company called Wellspring has a process to take the lithium out of that produced water, and that can be used for the batteries.
That's a huge step forward for national security in my eyes.
Absolutely.
Interesting to see that it's first of its kind is going to be manufactured here in Fargo. Dave, EPA has changed its mercury emissions rules, and that's a win for North Dakota's lignite coal industry. What's that all about?
Well, basically, the rules that they that were set earlier really wanted you to, you know, cut down on mercury emissions and get rid of them. So the new rule kind of leaves a little, it's not quite as strict, I'll say. And what it is that there will be allowed a bit of release of mercury, but still not to some of the, you know, when it started. But coal industry is saying, yes, this is going to save our coal plants, and because they won't have to be as strict about mercury emissions.
Dave Thompson, he's our news director here at Prairie Public. He'll be busy this weekend. He'll be following the Dem NPL convention. That's this weekend in Bismarck, and live blogging. You can stay up to date right here at prairiepublic.org. Dave, have fun this weekend. Enjoy your time, and thanks for joining us here on Main Street.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Still to come on today's Main Street, North Dakota Monitor reporter Mary Stoyer and North Dakota Monitor editor-in-chief Amy Dalrymple join us. We'll have an update on the high-profile lawsuit involving Energy Transfer and Greenpeace, plus a preview of the upcoming Dem NPL convention this weekend in Bismarck. That's ahead on today's Main Street. Stay with us. This is another edition of A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and this is our regular conversation with reporters from the North Dakota Monitor about stories that are impacting the region. We kind of do a deeper dive, and this week we're checking in a case that's drawn national and even international attention. It's the lawsuit brought by pipeline developer Energy Transfer against Greenpeace following protests surrounding the Dakota Access Pipeline. That was big news here in North Dakota for sure. A North Dakota judge recently finalized the court order requiring Greenpeace to pay roughly $345 million in damages. Now Greenpeace says it will seek a new trial. At the same time, another legal battle connected to the case is unfolding at the North Dakota Supreme Court, where Energy Transfer is trying to block a separate lawsuit filed by Greenpeace in the Netherlands. To help us unpack all of this and what may be happening and what's coming down the line, we're joined by North Dakota Monitor reporter Mary Stoyer. Mary, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's always great to visit with you, Mary. Let's start with the latest development. A judge recently finalized the order requiring Greenpeace to pay about $345 million in the pipeline case. What exactly does the order do, and why is this so significant?
It's basically making the jury's verdict official, which the jury's verdict initially came out nearly a year ago. So this is sort of a bookend to the multi-year saga of the case.
Case stems from protests that I think most of us remember against the Dakota Access Pipeline almost nearly a decade ago, Mary. That's hard to recall. Can you briefly remind listeners how the lawsuit came about?
So in the lawsuit, Energy Transfer alleges a few things. First, they say that Greenpeace engaged in / encouraged protesters to commit on the ground illegal acts against the pipeline, against some of the contractors who are working on it, etc. They also claim that Greenpeace was behind what they characterized as a misinformation campaign to make Energy Transfer look bad to the public. And then another big element of the case was that Energy Transfer claimed that Greenpeace caused lasting damage to Energy Transfer's financial health.
Judgment of this size is unusual for a case involving protests and activism. What arguments were made by Energy Transfer that justified those damages of that scale?
So there was a lot of evidence presented in court about them trying to attach a number to all of these alleged damages. So the trial ended up being 3 weeks, and they presented things like financial records. They had some expert witnesses come up and say, you know, here's what I calculated, here's how I got to this amount. But then, of course, Greenpeace kind of looked at that, and they also presented their own expert witnesses and tried to call all of those numbers into question. So that's kind of the gist of how they went about that, although there are too many little moving pieces probably for me to recount right here, just because it was such a long trial.
At the same time, Mary, Energy Transfer is asking the North Dakota Supreme Court to step in regarding another lawsuit Greenpeace filed in the Netherlands. Bring us up to speed as to what's happening there.
So Greenpeace countersued in a court in the Netherlands, and they are arguing that Energy Transfer filed its lawsuit in North Dakota as a veiled attempt to punish Greenpeace for being involved in the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. And Greenpeace, in the North Dakota lawsuit, their defense is basically that they were never a big part of the protests and they're getting picked on just because Energy Transfer wants to make an example out of them. And so there's a law in the European Union that is fairly new. I think Greenpeace says it's the first to file under this law, but the law basically says that organizations who believe that they're subject to an unfair sort of like freedom of speech lawsuit, the law says that they can ask to be made whole by a court or ask for a ruling in their favor.
One of the things I'm wondering about is how would a ruling in a Netherlands court impact what has already happened in United States courts, and specifically about the action you told us about that just happened, solidifying that $345 million judgment. How can a court ruling in the Netherlands impact what's happening here?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure how that would all play out. And so to get to what you brought up before, Greenpeace filed that lawsuit in the Netherlands. Energy Transfer asked the district court judge in North Dakota to try to stop that overseas lawsuit. He said no. They've appealed that to the Supreme Court. But the bigger question is, you know, like, does North Dakota have that power to control a lawsuit overseas? Slash, like, what's the ability of that overseas lawsuit to make a decision about something that's happening in North Dakota? That all remains to be seen, and it's definitely outside my area of expertise.
So Energy Transfer argues that the Dutch lawsuit is an attempt to intimidate or pressure the company. So how does Greenpeace characterize that case as it tries to move forward in a court in the Netherlands?
It characterizes its own case as trying to kind of make right on what they say went wrong in North Dakota from their point of view. So Greenpeace feels it didn't really get a friendly or fair venue in the North Dakota lawsuit. And so they see the Netherlands case as sort of one of their only avenues for justice. And what they say is an example of them being unfairly targeted.
So the litigation has drawn attention from environmental groups, free speech advocates, and the oil industry. Mary, do you have a sense of broader legal or political implications that this case could now have?
I think a lot of environmental activists and free speech advocates are concerned that it could be a blueprint that potentially other businesses look to go after people who are speaking out, and that could intimidate people into maybe thinking twice before they protest. I think people in the energy industry think that this judgment is an example of justice being served. And even Energy Transfer has said that they support free speech. They support like lawful protest, whatever they think that looks like. But that this one was an example of Greenpeace, in their words, going too far, and that they just think that, you know, Greenpeace should pay for that.
Do you have a sense, Mary, as to what legal experts are saying about this lawsuit now being filed by Greenpeace in the Netherlands?
I haven't had a chance to talk to them much, except for hearing what Greenpeace's own attorneys are saying about it. One interesting thing that happened was the state of North Dakota filed a brief in the North Dakota Supreme Court case where Energy Transfer appealed the district court judge's decision not to do anything to try to stop the Netherlands case. And in that brief, the North Dakota Attorney General's office said, you know, like, this is sort of a territory North Dakota courts haven't really ruled on yet. Please take this opportunity to add clarity to this issue of, like, when North Dakota courts can potentially try to stop legal actions in other countries. So kind of the vibe I got from that is that this is uncommon and that legal experts are looking for clarity in this area, at least when it comes to North Dakota.
As we wrap this part of our closer look with the monitor up, what are the next steps that we should be watching for in the case over the coming months?
So Greenpeace has said, in addition to requesting a new trial, it could try to file a request to have the judgment amended. It could also, if the request for a new trial isn't successful, appeal to the North Dakota Supreme Court. So that could potentially be in the future. For now, we're just waiting to see what its initial next steps will be, which, as I understand it, is the request for a new trial.
Mary Stoyer is a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor, where you can read more about the Greenpeace pipeline case and the lawsuits now that continue on surrounding the case. And you can also certainly keep up to date on other state and regional news at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. You can read all of their great reporting, free from paywalls, free from subscriptions, at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. Mary, thanks for joining us in this first segment of this A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thank you very much.
This edition of A Closer Look with the Monitor continues as we welcome back Amy Dalrymple. She's the editor-in-chief of the North Dakota Monitor. This weekend, Democrats from across North Dakota will gather in Bismarck for the Democratic NPL State Convention. These conventions have been a place where party members debate ideas, adopt policy positions, and begin shaping strategy for upcoming elections. In today's political environment, campaigns often unfold online and year-round. So the question is what is the role of a traditional party convention? How is it evolving? And now Amy joins us to talk about this weekend's gathering. Amy, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Hi, Craig. Happy to be here.
I'm glad that you are with us. So, Amy, as we talk about the upcoming convention here in Bismarck, what role is this convention playing for the political party in North Dakota? Is that role changing a bit?
Sure. Our team's going to be covering the Democratic convention that's meeting in Bismarck this weekend. And in North Dakota, candidates can access the ballot in one of two ways, either through an endorsement from a political party or by gathering signatures and filling out the required paperwork for the Secretary of State's office. And so with the Democrats, traditionally, they have continued to follow the convention process where candidates for U.S. House and other state offices are going to go to the convention and get the endorsement from their party members. We are seeing a bit of a shift with the Republican Party, where their convention, which we'll be covering later in March, their convention, some would say, is becoming less relevant because we're seeing more candidates skip the convention and just go straight to gathering signatures instead and accessing the primary ballot that way.
Amy, what kinds of other decisions or activities happen during a convention like what we'll see this weekend?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing that we're going to be watching for is who they endorse for U.S. House in particular. There are three candidates for House. We're also going to be watching if any candidates emerge for other statewide offices that are on the ballot. As of right now, they have not announced any candidates for Public Service Commission, for Commissioner of Agriculture, for Attorney General, and for a few other big positions that are on the ballot. So we'll be curious to see if any emerge this weekend. The other thing that they will be discussing is they'll discuss their party platform and some resolutions.
So are there major policy issues then that you expect to be discussed, debated, maybe even somewhat controversial within the party? What are you looking for?
Well, there is one resolution that's proposed that I've seen on their website that calls for immediate reform of ICE enforcement. And so I expect that will get quite a bit of debate, particularly due to the enforcement actions in Minnesota. They also have other resolutions that they're going to be discussing. I expect the free school meals ballot measure will be kind of a popular topic, as well as other themes that relate to agriculture and land stewardship, community protection for energy and land. They also have a topic they're going to be discussing related to data centers and artificial intelligence. So I think there's going to be a lot of topics that are pretty timely, and then some traditional topics like workforce, healthcare, childcare, housing, some of the things that they've traditionally advocated for. I think those will be common themes as well.
What are you looking for relative to turnout or participation in this week's Dem NPL convention? What do you think that might say about the party's energy or momentum?
Yeah, well, our reporter, Michael Ochterling, he's been doing some reporting on this, and he's seeing a really strong interest in attending the convention from districts across the state. The party predicts that they might have 400 to 500 people participating, which would be the largest participation in about 8 years.
Are there any notable speakers that you're looking forward to covering?
Yeah, there's going to be a few. The two that probably will stand out the most on Saturday are the mayor of Denver, Mike Johnston. Former Senator Heidi Heitkamp is a special guest as well. And she's also going to be moderating a panel that looks interesting to me. It's called The Red Zone, Making Your Case in Mega Land.
Finally, stepping back just a little bit, do you anticipate then more Dem NPL candidates on North Dakota ballots this year, Amy?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot more enthusiasm from Democrats and more interest in running for the state legislature. We're not seeing as many with the statewide candidates so far, but the legislative ticket is a lot fuller than it has been in many years. And so I think this year, voters are going to see more choices on their ballots.
That's Amy Dalrymple. She's the editor-in-chief of the North Dakota Monitor, and she and her team will be covering the Democratic NPL convention this weekend in Bismarck. Amy, thanks again for joining us with a closer look with the Monitor.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And you, I should note that you can find Amy and her whole team's reporting online at northdakotamonitor.com, where this podcast also resides, and you can also, of course, listen to it on Thursdays at Prairie Public, and it drops Friday morning at NorthDakotaMonitor.com, always free from paywalls or subscriptions. This is Craig Blumenschein for Prairie Public. If you're listening to Main Street during our 3 p.m. Central broadcast, All Things Considered is next. We hope you'll stay with us for a story about a new twist for addressing America's housing affordability crisis. Developers are building houses not to sell, but to rent. Could building houses to rent help with the housing crisis by easing the shortage? Listen to that story and more on All Things Considered that follows Main Street right here on Prairie Public. At 8 p.m. Central tonight, it's The Middle Live with host Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy asks the question, do you care about the Epstein files as a voter? That's tonight at 8 p.m. right here on Prairie Public.
More than 1,600 plants and animals are protected under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. But out of all of those, only one is a moss. Harvest Public Media's Kate Grumke reports on a new effort to protect these tiny plants that are important but often overlooked.
On a cold January morning in a nature reserve outside of St. Louis, almost everything is brown and dry. But with a certain type of scientist in tow, soon you're seeing the forest in a new way and headed toward little patches of green.
I leave the trail as soon as I can. Trails are to get me to near the bryophytes, and then I just run around in the woods.
John Brinda is a bryologist at the Missouri Botanical Garden. Bryologists study bryophytes, a group that includes mosses and other small plants called liverworts and hornworts. In the woods, Brinda spends a lot of time squinting at moss through a magnifying hand lens he wears around his neck.
Look at the different colors. This has a different texture to it. Like this is flatter and smoother, and this is more rough.
What Brinda and many bryologists have in common is an appreciation for the little guy. Mosses are underdogs, but that can be a problem. They don't get much attention even among scientists, so there's a lot we don't know about them. And you can't protect a species if you don't know it's struggling. That's why Brinda and a group of scientists from across Canada and the U.S. are forming the Bryophyte Conservation Alliance to help understand and protect these plants. Ohio State University's Mandy Slate is part of the team.
It's just this like missing link to understanding the entire ecosystem that we've just kind of overlooked.
Slate says these tiny plants are a super important part of their natural communities. They store carbon and impact how water moves. They're also habitats themselves. If you zoom in really close to a patch of mosses, it's like a mini forest, full of even smaller creatures. But Slate says there's a lot left to learn about mosses and other bryophytes.
We don't know where they actually occur. We don't know their abundance in those locations, and we don't know any threats. But all of that information is needed together at the same time to really understand how a species is doing.
And you need all of that data to get protection from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The only moss currently protected by the agency is the South Llano Springs moss, an endangered plant whose only known population is on one private ranch in Texas. Chris Best is the scientist who did the species assessment for that moss.
To our knowledge, there's only male individuals left in that population, and it is even possible that the entire population consists of clones of a single surviving individual. We really don't know.
Best recently retired after 19 years as the Texas State Botanist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says plants get a lot less conservation attention than animals at the federal agency.
We have very few botanists in the whole country.
And mosses are an even smaller specialty within botany. Keir Wefferling studies mosses at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. He has a deep respect for these plants and wonders why there's so little attention paid to them.
It's not a lack of ecological relevance. I don't know, I think it's because they're small and hard to identify, maybe? I don't know, but it's nonsense. It's sad, and maybe one could say it's an opportunity for education and outreach.
While more legal protections for mosses would be welcome, Wefferling says the Bryophyte Conservation Alliance is about more than just federal lists. They're hoping to inspire people to take a closer look at these little plants. I'm Kate Grumke, Harvest Public Media.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 5th. At one time, North Dakota could have claimed recognition as the third largest nuclear power if it were a separate country, with about 250 Minuteman III missiles, each carrying up to three warheads. Deterring Soviet aggression was a primary goal of the United States during the Cold War. Several factors led to placing nuclear missiles in the state. The wide expanses of open land allowed them to be located far from densely populated areas. This also made the sites easier to protect. And while it may seem counterintuitive, it is actually a shorter flight path to Russia from North Dakota over the North Pole than it is from a state farther west across the Bering Strait. This was part of America's strategy to build a rapid response capability. Minot became the center of missile activity. It was home to 150 intercontinental ballistic missiles, along with missile alert facilities, and thousands of airmen who maintained the missiles and would have launched them if necessary. Grand Forks Air Force Base joined the system in 1964 with the addition of 150 Minuteman missiles. The missile sites had a significant impact on North Dakota. Construction provided jobs and stimulated local economies. The work broadened an economy that had relied primarily on agriculture. It brought new people into the state, increasing demand for housing and schools. The downside was a reliance on military spending, which has fluctuated over the years. The emphasis on nuclear weapons shifted when the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty went into effect on this date in 1970. Both the United States and the Soviet Union had an interest in slowing the pace of the arms race. Research and development of nuclear weapons were extremely expensive, and both powers understood the massive destruction a nuclear strike would cause. Fortunately, nuclear tension between the two antagonists never turned into a shooting war. As the Cold War cooled and the Berlin Wall fell, the United States and Russia began drawing down their arsenals. Missiles were removed from North Dakota, although some still remain. The state's economy had to adjust as large numbers of service members and their families left. Visitors can learn more about North Dakota's missile history at the Ronald Reagan Minuteman Missile State Historic Site in Cooperstown. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
New year.
I want to ask about the United States Senate for 2026. This is a map where...
New beginnings.
So, Scott, what's your sense of how this is going to play out?
New stories.
Wow, wasn't expecting that. What do they want out of this lawsuit?
Wherever 2026 takes us, Morning Edition from NPR News will be there. Stay informed with us every weekday morning.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. Central on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Monday on Main Street, student mental health shows up in many ways in schools, from stress and disengagement to behavior challenges. Monday, two North Dakota Teachers of the Year, Sheila Peterson and Franny Tunsa, share how educators are supporting students through relationships, trauma-sensitive practices, and tiered supports. From Bismarck to Mayville, the goal is the same, helping every student feel seen, heard, and supported. We hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we'll see you again Monday right here on Main Street.